Another House Democrats are supporting the initiative, including Michigan's Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian American woman in Congress. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, June 6, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we spend the hour with Ernesto Castañeda to discuss the myths versus realities of immigrant life at a time when we are seeing unprecedented punitive punishment against people of color, whether immigrant or otherwise. And so we are joined today, as I said before, with Ernesto Castañeda. He's the director of the Immigration Lab and the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at American University here in Washington. He's also the author of a new book entitled Immigration Realities, Challenging Common Misperceptions, which is co-authored by Karina Sioni and Ernesto Castañeda. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Oscar. It's a pleasure to be back.
Absolutely. So as we have this conversation today, we have seen viral videos of ICE agents detaining and arresting construction workers, protesters, teenagers, college students. We've even seen children as young as 8 or 10 years old tied up in zip ties, as was the case in San Antonio, Texas. This is a far cry from the narrative, quote unquote, of arresting criminals, quote unquote, as the Trump administration would like people to believe. In the past week alone, there have been raids taking place in California, Texas, Florida, Massachusetts, Tennessee, just to name a few places. And as an example, here's a report from the CBS affiliate in Boston earlier this week, following an estimated 1,500 people who were arrested by ICE in the past month. This clip also includes interesting comments from acting director Todd Lyons. Let's take a listen.
Authorities laying out the work ICE has done over the last few months, saying that almost 1,500 people have been detained during immigration raids across Massachusetts, and they're urging the state to not get in their way. Good afternoon. I'm Paula Eben. This is the first time that federal authorities have publicly talked about their immigration crackdown here in Massachusetts. Authorities say they've detained 1,461 people in the last month, and they claim most of them are violent criminal offenders. They gave some examples, but did not give firm numbers. The head of the Boston Customs Office urged state and local officials to work with ICE and not stand in their way.
If sanctuary cities would change their policies and turn these violent criminal aliens over to us into our custody, instead of releasing them into the public, we would not have to go out to the communities and do this. Boston's my hometown, and it really shocks me that officials all over Massachusetts would rather release sex offenders, fentanyl dealers, drug dealers, human traffickers, and child rapists back into the neighborhoods.
Now, the authorities were asked about the Milford High School student who was picked up over the weekend. They acknowledged he was not the target of the operation, but he's 18, so they said he is in the country illegally and is an adult. People in Milford are demanding his release.
So that was a CBS affiliate in Boston, and they were referencing towards the very end there the case of Marcelo Gomez da Silva, undocumented Brazilian migrant who was grabbed by ICE in sort of the same way as the Kilmer Abrego Garcia case, which was by the administration's own admission an administrative error. But we'll get to that later. In the meantime, there were some choice words there from acting ICE director Todd Lyons, which brought up the same tropes that you sort of address in your book. And I have to tell you the same thing I told you before we started recording. It is unavoidable to not mention recent events as we discuss your book. So let's begin by discussing the thesis of your book against the backdrop of these recent events.
Yes, Oscar. So the main goal of the book is to illustrate the realities about the complex phenomenon of human immigration today, particularly into the US, contrasting it to the many things we hear politicians and other people who are not experts say in the media about immigrants and immigration. So that's what the book is doing, educating the public. It's accessible, and it summarizes dozens, actually hundreds of studies by people across the social sciences and other disciplines talking about the specifics of immigration implications, reasons, history, effects, etc. Because there is a lot of misinformation that the public has, and there's a lot of misinformation that elected officials and people like the ones we hear from are spouting into the public. So as an example for what you just shared with the audience, here Ted Lyons is misrepresenting, for political reasons, what it means to be a sanctuary city. Because Boston today has a person of immigrant origin, Asian, as the mayor. She's doing a fantastic job, a young professional, a young mother, who is actually being a very courageous mayor and has spoken in Congress in favor of sanctuary city procedures and policies, along with the mayors of New York City, Chicago, and others. So a sanctuary jurisdiction doesn't mean that the police gets on the way of ICE and other immigration authorities. Local police cannot do that. Federal police has the precedence, and they have the right to apprehend the people that they do. And I haven't seen any case of a police coming in between a federal agent, ICE, and local residents. They could do that. They haven't done that. And that's not what sanctuary means. It's also misleading. Maybe there's an example here and there and a few errors and exceptions. But to be a sanctuary jurisdiction doesn't mean that a city, state, etc., is going to capture a drug trafficker, a child molester, etc., and release them just because they're immigrants. That's not true. If somebody is doing a crime, they're detained, they're taken to court, they're found guilty, they get processed like anybody else, and after that, they may be deported. Never does it mean that to be a sanctuary means that it's a crime-free zone or a zone where immigrants are free to commit crimes. That's not the case. So first of all, that's a misleading there, but we heard in the press and in the past about the non-existing effects of sanctuary cities. That's one. Then second, to go back to the way you started, what we're seeing today with all these deportations of people around the country are, as I said many times to different media before the election, that this would be what a mass deportation looks like. What do I mean by that? Even though, yes, during the campaign, sometimes he will blame Mara Salvatrucha, Salvadorians, crazy Mexican homicides. Depending on the day and the election, the enemy will be different. Sometimes it'll be Haitians eating, quote-unquote, cats and dogs, supposedly in Ohio. Other times it became Tren de Aragua from Venezuela. So there was a different enemy depending on the flavor and what news were carrying. So Trump supposedly promising to deport the worst criminals, the most violent people, and that's where they will stop. And supposedly some voters believe that, and that's what they border for, including some people of Latino origin or immigrant origin. Now, in reality, we know, and there's a chapter in the Immigration Realities book, there's a lot of evidence that undocumented immigrants have a crime rate that is many times lower than that of the U.S.-born citizens, or even lower than that of documented migrants. So therefore, in order to deport the numbers of people that Obama or Biden deported, it's a fact that quota, that number, that goal million people a year, or other numbers that have been floating around, that cannot be reached only by the criminals, the violent criminals, because there is not enough to go around to do this. What happens is that among the undocumented population, we have wives, housemakers, children going to school, young adults, people going to cancer treatment, people that look like many other people that are not immigrants, but may lack immigrant authorization. So they are the ones that are going to be the collateral damage of these raids and these campaigns of mass deportation. That was always going to be the case. What is interesting now is that while politicians in the past have used the specter of the criminal alien to legitimate or to sell or to justify raids, mass deportations, ICE activity in the interior, and then people don't really see and really look at the details. And with Obama, a lot of this happened. Media, with people recording it on their phones, with the media paying more attention, people are more aware than ever about who are the people getting deported, and they are not liking what they are seeing because it's cruel, it's unfair, it's unjust, it's people that are high school students, church members, etc. So the good thing is that the public is understanding more of the reality of who are the undocumented people living in the country, that the experts and members of the community, we know for a long time that we're not talking about monsters, we're not talking about aliens in the science fiction term, but we're talking about people like everyone else. So that's a distinction that is becoming very clear, and I think that bodes bad news for the Trump administration.
In the meantime, however, we are seeing, as I said before, a lot of these viral videos of ICE going in military garb, going to places and detaining not criminals, but children and mothers, and even people who are sick as well. There was this story about a month or less than a month ago, actually, of the young girl from Honduras who's in the middle of stage 4 cancer treatment as well. And I mentioned at the top of the show about children as young as 8 or 10 years old tied up in zip ties. That's exactly what happened in the case in San Antonio. It's hard to keep both of all these horrific cases because they just divorce immigrants from their humanity, that it's hard to keep up, and you hope that you won't get to the point of being desensitized from the whole thing in the process. Which leads me to one component of your book, which discusses the conflation of being undocumented with immorality. And I know you sort of addressed this to a certain degree already, but perhaps the most striking example of this is the case of Gilmar Abrego Garcia, a Salvadoran living in Maryland who was detained by ICE and sent to the Secot prison in El Salvador under what the Trump administration admitted was an administrative error. Here is White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt's response when asked about the Abrego Garcia case earlier this year. Let's take a listen, because again, this sort of addresses something that you already pointed out. Let's take a listen.
Jeff, a few minutes ago, you said you'd seen evidence that this man was a convicted gang member. In what court was he convicted and for what?
This individual was an MS-13 ringleader. This individual was also engaged in human trafficking. And I'm glad you brought up this point again, because I would like to point out that if you just saw the headline from the insane failing Atlantic magazine this morning, you would think this individual was father of the year, living in Maryland, living a peaceful life, when that couldn't be further from the truth. They didn't even mention in the title of that article or even in the first paragraph that this individual is an illegal criminal who broke our nation's immigration laws. He is a leader in the brutal MS-13 gang, and he is involved in human trafficking, and now MS-13 is a designated foreign terrorist organization. Foreign terrorists have no legal protections in the United States of America, and this administration is going to continue to deport foreign terrorists and illegal criminals from our nation's interior.
But a judge ordered that he should remain in this country. So are you saying that it is okay to ignore a judge's ruling if you don't like it?
Who does that judge work for?
He's an immigration
It was
judge.
An immigration judge who works for the Department of Justice at the direction of the Attorney General of the United States, whose name is Pam Bondi, who has committed to eradicating MS-13 from our nation's interior. And let me tell you why we've made this commitment. MS-13, may I remind each and every one of you, is a brutal and vicious gang. They raped and strangled a 20-year-old autistic woman to death in Maryland. They hacked 4 people to death with machetes in a park on Long Island. They have kidnapped, sexually tortured, and shot a teenage girl in Texas after she insulted them, allegedly.
So she goes about this non sequitur that has nothing to do with Gilmar Abrego Garcia, the individual. But you sort of get the idea of where this clip was going. So upon listening to this clip, what do you make of this conflation between undocumented with immorality? Because I feel like we have gotten to the point, and I'm saying this as a Salvadoran, that we have gotten to the point where it's almost becoming unconscious, where the idea of El Salvador, the country and the people as a whole, automatically leads people in their minds to criminality. And the same can be said to Venezuelan migrants. The same can be said to Mexican migrants. It is being instilled in people's heads in a way that's disinforming the general public to the point where they're not even conscious of it, unfortunately.
That's right. That's right. That's the most dangerous thing, that it creates stereotypes and prejudices that then people act on without necessarily being conscious about it. That's why this is very dangerous and very effective on the long term, but again, also unfair and misfounded on reality. So on one side, it is a fact that there are people in the United States without up-to-date immigration papers. Nobody's denying that. We're talking around 11 million people. That's a lot of stories, individual lives, family drama. And it means a lot for those people that cannot do many things that are normal for many of us, getting a loan easily, traveling to visit family members that may be sick abroad, things like that, that having no immigration papers keeps you captive in one country and is mobile and in this constant fear of deportation that could happen. So that is the sad part. That is the reality. But this is only 3.3% of the people that reside in the United States. So meaning, are we going to spend half of the federal budget, as in the big, beautiful bill, quote unquote, on protecting the border and giving more money to ICE, Border Patrol, et cetera, for these girls needing cancer treatment, these mothers, these children, the men working, and a few criminals that can be dealt with, the criminal justice system? Talk about a waste of resources and putting things out of proportion. So the issue is how immigration status or undocumented status creates hurdles to integration and creates human suffering. Unfortunately, as we document in this book, for many years, the narrative in the media, in the news media, in mainstream media, in crime shows, in TV, in kids talking in the playground, is that brown-looking young men, they are probably undocumented and they are probably criminals, either connected to drug trafficking, or now more and more they claim that they are connected to human trafficking, or that they are gang members. And again, there are Latino gang members in the U.S. There's black gangs in the U.S. There are white gangs in the U.S. That's not, that is true. But most white people are not part of a biker gang. Most black people are not part of a gang. Most Latinos are not part of a gang. And there's laws that we have to deal with gangs that are actually violent. So that's another reality. In the case of Gilmar Abrego Garcia, a Central American person that comes to the U.S. as a young, unaccompanied minor and established himself a long time ago, in Maryland. Now, we're not saying that all immigrants from any of these countries, or whether they're coming from China or Europe, are undocumented. We're not saying that they are saints. We're not saying that they are perfect. We're not saying that all of them are valedictorian, serving the military, going to college, and all of them should deserve DACA as deserving good immigrants. People are people, and they're going to have defects, and they're not. Nobody's saying that they are perfect and they never commit any crime. But do we have a legal system, a rule of law that takes care of people that commit crime? And being undocumented doesn't protect you from going to prison, from other things that a citizen will face, rather than the influence, whatever. So with Gilmar, there was an interaction with the police where there were some claims made, but the judge at the time dismissed those charges. So all the things that we were hearing saying from the White House spokesperson, no judge find them to be credible. Otherwise, he would have been deported during the first Trump administration. When this happened, when this came to the attention of immigration authorities, it was when Trump was already present. It was the first administration. The immigration judges decided that there was not enough evidence that he was a member of a gang, that he was committing any crimes. Even if there were people in the vicinity that were doing things that were illegal, he was never convicted of a crime. He's innocent. Innocent of the proven guilty. And if anybody has benefited of that, it's been Trump and others. So again, there's something of domestic violence that happened. That's between him and his wife. The wife pardoned him. She's spoken about it. There were issues of maybe he traveling across state borders with other people in the car, stopped by a police officer. There was an interaction. It was recorded. It was released. Again, there's no smoking gun there. And the authorities decided not to do anything there. And again, he didn't kill anybody. He didn't commit any crimes. So he is innocent. Now, in this new Trump administration, 2.0, they have this huge pressure to deport people quickly. They have decided that it's not worth the while to go to due process, to present somebody to an immigration court, who are many of them asking for asylum, are going to be denied asylum and are going to put in deportation proceedings. That happens to a lot of people. That's how a lot of people were deported during the Obama years. Or at the border, people signing the deportation at the border because they just arrived. That happened during the Biden years. So right now, Trump is wanted to fulfill this campaign promise. The only one he's really worried about, it seems, to follow his, continue on his promises. So they're taking shortcuts to make it faster, easier, and to have more people. So they're going for people that are already interfacing with the justice system. A lot of people come into their ICE checkup, come into the court date, and then from there being captured by the authorities. So it's not the people that have been living under the shadows for a lot of years. They're probably going to continue living in the shadows. It's not good for them, but the government may not know where they are. But these are people that a lot of people sent to Secot on that March 15 of 2025. Were people who entered the U.S. legally. They used the CBP-1 that was the program that the Biden administration put for this. The government knew where they live. They had work permits. They were asking for asylum. They were in the process. They had a legal status, or they were in the process of acquiring one, and they were deported. So already the U.S. is violating its own law. There's this case, for example, of Julio Zambrano Perez, Venezuelan, young guy working in North Carolina. He goes to his ICE court appointment. His wife and his baby girl is let go. The wife is 9 months pregnant. But he is stopped, like Kilmer Garcia Abrego, because he has tattoos. Crown, the name of the mother, the name of the kid, his name tattooed. And therefore, these unprofessional criminologists, these newbie police that think they know anything about Latin American gangs, that come out of nowhere because Mara Salvatrucha may have gangs, may have tattoos that identify some of the members. So that's the cartoon. You could make the case. For Trinidad Agua, they don't have any tattoos, but they came up in the processes that if you have any tattoo, you get some points. And after some points, it proved that you were a member of the gang and therefore you could be deported spiritually.
Yeah, that component of what we've seen this year alone is so bad that we actually did a whole episode just on the criminalization of people based on tattoos alone, which, as you just pointed out, is quite absurd. And just to support your argument, again, it's so hard to keep up with all these insane stories because it's easy to forget the fact that in New Mexico earlier this year, ICE detained indigenous Navajos, Native American people, because they look like Latinos. They look like you and me. And there was another case in Wisconsin where ICE agents detained Puerto Ricans. Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, for those who may not know. But again, we have a very informed audience here on WPFW. So with that said, I've done several of these shows over the years with regards to the struggle for immigrant rights in various forms, in various parts of the country. What I never foresaw at any point in time was this sudden focus, attention, and targeting of overseas students. This is something I could have never imagined. And just to get the timelines correct, I think your book came out in late September or in October of last year, before the elections in November. And so the idea of targeting overseas students was, by and large, off the radar. And so I'm curious to know if your book directly or indirectly addresses the realities of this particular community, because it's unfortunately opened up a new avenue of xenophobia and the very misperceptions that you address in your book.
That's right, Oscar. So I don't talk about it directly, but it is an extension of that xenophobia. When you say that everybody coming from Latin America is suspect, when you're saying that somebody from Venezuela or El Salvador, just because they have a tattoo, therefore they are legally, they are members of a gang, and now declared by the country they are legally terrorists, and they should be deported. Once you justify that, then you put into question any foreigner. Once you say that China is doing unfair trade with the U.S. and they're out there to get us, you're going to try to get rid of all the Chinese citizens, which Trump has been saying since the first administration. He had in the mark already Chinese scientists working in the U.S., Chinese visiting students, etc. But also during the debates and during the campaign, Trump and Kamala Harris said that they should stamp a green card or a passport to the diplomas of all the international students finishing college in the U.S., that they should stay in the United States because they will be a plus. They were already educated in the U.S., in our great universities, that there will be a plus and they shouldn't go back. So that's also that Trump, something that Trump promised during the campaign. He's forgotten that. And now he's trying to get rid of immigrants. And this is connected to that. So although in the past, the Republicans have said that they are pro-immigrant, but they're against illegal immigration, that is false because they're deporting people who are applying for asylum. They stop refugee resettlement. They are rescinding the temporary protective status from Afghans, from Ukrainians. So a lot of people that work illegally, they're even deported, some people that have green cards. So nobody's safe. They're trying to go for the children of immigrants with the birthright citizenship. They're trying to denaturalize people that became citizens. So people that are very legal, they're also trying to question their Americanness. So therefore, it's not crazy that then now our international students and scholars are at the crosshairs. But this goes two ways. So first of all, it's eliminating foreign elements from American culture. That is kind of the MAGA pipe dream. Very hard to do. But second of all, this is also another way to attack the universities, the free media, the critics of any authoritarian regime, which are going to base the universities and are going to benefit from this freedom of speech on campus and are going to protest and do things and speak their minds about political issues and moral issues. So a way to attack this is to say, okay, we have these rabble rousers from abroad that are engaging in U.S. and international relation politics. That getting on the way of the Secretary of State, we have to deport it from the national interest. And they are finding laws hidden in the books that support this account. But let me just give you two other examples that we see around the world that are covered indirectly in the book. The one is that when the conservative movement in the UK was trying to advance the campaign for Brexit,
yes,
which was also based on lies and blaming the foreigners and the European immigrants in the UK, many of them in English universities, the conservative government in England lowered the number of people that could get a student visa. Because that's a way to weaken institutions that have already received big cuts from federal funds from the UK to the universities. So you already weaken them financially by giving them less support, which has been happening in the US for decades, since Reagan. And then on top of that, some of the few income sources for the universities these days, and I know as a university professor, are through research dollars, working on new vaccines, medicines through NIH, basic science through NSF, development in El Salvador through USAID. All these things have been cut by Musk and Trump. And the other source of support and income, besides native local students that are getting, that have been told not to go to college, that is a waste of time. The other important source of income are international students who normally pay more and bring a lot of resources from abroad to subsidize or to help pay for our great research universities. They benefit a lot from that knowledge, but it's another way of attacking Harvard, which is a political reason. If you want to weaken Harvard, you don't let them enroll the 27% of international students they have. That attacks the scientific enterprise, that attacks the freedom of speech, the attractiveness of Harvard and its financial model and its admissions model. So it's a multi-pronged attack that plays really well with these nativist and anti-elitist, supposedly, impulses.
We're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Ernesto Castañeda, who's the director of the Immigration Lab and the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at American University. He's also the author of a new book entitled Immigration Realities, Challenging Common Misperceptions. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Oh, nas escolas, nas ruas.
That was Gerardo Vandre, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, reminding everyone that you follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show, and of course live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about immigrant realities with Ernesto Castañeda, who's the director of the Immigration Lab and the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at American University here in Washington. He's also the author of Immigration Realities, Challenging Common Misperceptions, which is co-authored by Karina Sioni. And so I want to go now to our last conversation, which is right about this time last year, because when we spoke with you last year, it was on how the Biden administration issued one of the most restrictive immigration policies ever declared under a Democratic administration. During the time last year, it temporarily shut down the U.S.-Mexico border, denied asylum to most migrants who do not cross into the U.S. via ports of entry, and limit total asylum requests at the southern border to no more than 2,500 per day. So during the course of our last conversation, you explained how these actions were no different from the first Trump administration. One year later, could you tell the audience, based on your book, how what we're seeing now does not happen in a vacuum? And before you answer that, I just want to point out that you mentioned the CBP app earlier in the conversation, in the first half of the conversation. I just want to remind the audience that Amnesty International pointed out that the CBP One app was a violation of people's rights to seeking asylum. But continue, please.
No, absolutely. A number of things here. So first of all, there was the president of Trump during the pandemic using the Title 42 of the public health code to close the border for public health reasons because we had a pandemic. And the border was closed to asylum seekers, which is something that shouldn't happen according to U.S. immigration law and international law. But it went on. And then Biden extended that as long as he could, as long as he wasn't untenable after he said that the pandemic was over otherwise. But they extended that Title 42 as far as they could. And they had thought about bringing back Title 40, Remain in Mexico, which were bad ideas that Trump started and then Biden continued. After the border reopens, you see an uptick of people that have been waiting for years in Mexico to try to claim asylum in the U.S., coming and asking for asylum. That coincides with crisis in Haiti, in Venezuela, continued crisis in Cuba, and the growing dictatorship and persecution of political enemies and journalists, etc., from Nicaragua. So these groups bump into historical high numbers, historically high numbers. And then the Biden administration, to their credit, creatively, little by little, without trying to be too humanitarian, but they produce a program only for those four groups, where they can enter and ask asylum. And they fly. But the problem there is that the Biden administration allows them illegally so they wouldn't crowd the border and look bad on the news for them, because they thought they would pay a political cost for the border looking, quote unquote, chaotic. But at the same time, they didn't. I think we discussed it last year, that it was a temporary program. They were allowed illegally, but they were given only 2 years to be here. And then they had to figure it out on themselves. So that wasn't a solution on the long term. So we're seeing the consequences of that because they didn't provide a pathway to citizenship, to regularization, or something that was more decisive. Now all those people are in limbo and the Trump administration can easily take away the status. And that's where we are fighting in the courts. But these people could become illegalized in any moment. And again, that's kind of a direct effect of the Biden administration, who created a good way for them to come legally, but it was a short-term band-aid that now we're going to strip it and feel the pain, maybe double. As you were saying earlier, Oscar, and that's true, even though people have the right to arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border, present themselves, raise your hands, and say to the Border Patrol, hi, I'm here with my family, we're asking for asylum. We are afraid of going back to our country because X, Y, and Z. Then you're supposed to be allowed in and see an immigration court to make your case for asylum. The Biden administration violated the law by not letting people arrive into the border and working with the Mexican government, deporting a lot of people before it reached the border, and or imposing this new app on the phone where the immigrants, many of them in Mexico, had to go to the app, had to, a pilot had to function, it wasn't working with everybody, these details that we discussed in the past. But then you had to apply remotely via an app in order to get an appointment to claim asylum, claim legal entry in the U.S., which was an improvement, but it meant that the border became further sealed and you could no longer ask for asylum at a time where undocumented or clandestine or undetected attempts to cross have gone down. So that was the Biden administration. So what happens now? During the Trump administration, the U.S.-Mexico border is actually pretty much sealed. Trade is happening. Legal immigration is happening. Millions of people travel every day. But if you don't have papers or if you're trying to ask asylum, you're not coming through. And you're not even trying. And the Mexican army is making it harder. So funny enough, Trump is already victorious in closing the border. He's not asking for too much credit. He sometimes mentions it, but kind of people don't take it seriously. The border was never dangerous, as we say in the book. But the border is closed. But more than anything, that's thanks to the Biden administration that make it harder to ask for asylum, as you said, and the Mexican administration helping a lot in this task because they're afraid of the trade quotas going out, the tariffs. And as I said 1 year ago when we talked, Biden was doing these very anti-immigrant, Republican, xenophobic policies because they thought that was a smart political thing to do. But as I told you last year, I think Biden was not going to get any political credit for this. And he didn't. People don't credit him for that. It's not a good thing, but he helped have the secure border that we have today. But people misunderstand that. And now the emphasis has become rather on the deportation from people from the interior. And that's where the action is. And that's where people, Biden deported a lot of people easily that had just arrived or they were at the border, Haitians and others. But now Trump, in order to match the Biden and the Obama numbers, he has to remove a lot of people from the interior, but a lot of people are watching, documenting it, filming and talking about it, talking to the media about it. So there's going to be a big political cost, I think, for a lot of Republicans.
What the Biden administration did last year, to put it politely, was a cynical form of incrementalism to appease Republicans that went nowhere. And as a result, asylum seekers are the ones that are paying the cost for it. But you also mentioned something very important that segues into my next question, which is asylum seekers are basically sealed from coming to the country, but trade is moving freely and flowingly as usual. And that gives you a very sad indictment that capital is more important than human life, especially those of asylum seekers. And so that segues into my next question, as I said, because as a means to both humanize and address the working class nature of migrants in this country, could you explain how you address the issues of remittances in your book and how the pursuit of remittances can better inform the public, especially when we're inundated with this narrative of criminals and all this sort of negative things towards immigrants? This is a component that I feel that not only is missing from the narrative, but as I said before, can better inform the public as to why people migrate in the first place.
Great question, Oscar. So yes, on the people migrate mainly for two reasons. They're escaping war or persecution, a genocide of Guatemala in the 80s by the regime, Afghanistan, Ukraine. They're escaping for their lives, or they're looking for better economic opportunities. And when they can leave their family behind, a lot of family members, a lot of young parents may decide, because that's something that is possible in their hometowns, to go abroad. Filipina women going to Saudi Arabia or the Emirates, Central American, Mexican, young men initially, then women, coming to work in the U.S. to send money, that's the remittances, the money that they work from their sweat, from their many hours working at low-paid jobs often, the little wages that they make, they send between 17.5 to 20% of that income. They send it to their kids, their babies, their young kids, their spouse living back in Latin America. And every once in a while, for the mother that may be sick and may need to buy a medicine that they cannot afford it, so that you're going to send extra money for that. But remittances are the best evidence that immigrants are working, because they were not working or making an income, they have no money to send. Welfare is not big enough for them to be able to survive and then send money. That's not the case. Also, we talk about how the welfare myth is not true in the book with a lot of evidence. But also remittances means that these families are separated, not only by the Trump administration at the border, like during the first administration, but that there's this conscious, quote-unquote, decision of leaving your children behind for 10, 12 years. And that's the story of the other book that we discussed last year. Reunited, when the parents are, let's say, in the Washington region and the children are back in Central America, and therefore you send the remittances. Right now, in the big, beautiful bill, there is a provision that maybe has skipped a lot of people that are not immigrants, when there is a 3.5% tax on all remittances. And that is unfair because most of the remittances are coming from wages, and wages that immigrants earn have already been taxed by their employers or the businesses that they own. They already contributed to Social Security that many of them will never see. They're undocumented. They're already paying Maryland, Virginia, or Washington taxes accordingly to the local laws. They're paying federal taxes. And they're getting their money, their taxes withheld. And then from that income that is already being taxed, they're sending some of that money to the family members abroad. They're going to be taxed again. So that's double taxation. And the other one is that if you tax it, well, they're going to find more informal ways to do it. They're going to have a family member travel and bring the money for a lot of people. They're going to buy goods. They're going to do it online. Maybe the Trump administration wants some of the remittances money to go to crypto, and maybe he thinks he'll benefit that way. So this is an injustice that immigrants are suffering from that separation, family separation. They're not making enough money, and then they have to pay not only to Western Union a fee or to the people doing the transaction, but now they have to probably pay a tax and face the consequences if they don't pay it. And let me just walk you really quick to an exercise that we just did at the Immigration Lab. So in 2022, there were $81 billion that left in remittances to the U.S. So Trump and others say, oh, there's a lot of money that we're bleeding, that we're losing from the economy. But how we should really understand it is if these immigrants from other parts of the world were not working here, they wouldn't produce the wealth that is used to pay their wages, which then they used to pay for a lot of things locally, rent, food, transportation, and a portion only of that goes abroad. So we calculated that only in 2022, immigrants sending remittances, which is not every immigrant, immigrants sending remittances, some of them with paper, some of them without, they contributed $2.2 trillion to the U.S. economy. That's 8% of the gross domestic product. And in 2023, immigrants sending remittances produce 10% of the GDP. So if you deport half of them, we're going to be in an economic crisis when our GDP is going to go down by 4 or 5% when it only went up by 2 or 3% in the last few years. So Trump is playing with fire by taxing remittances, by not letting refugees in, by closing the border to asylum seekers, by deporting people, by ending the investment in science and education, and putting tariffs. We're going to face horrible economic future economic crisis that can be directly attributed not to immigrants, not to foreigners, not to China, but to the decisions of the Trump administration.
I've always made the argument that the free movement of capital undermines democracy. And in this context, it's happening to the detriment of working class migrants. Because as you said before, that is going to create an economic disaster to places like Guatemala or El Salvador, just to name a few places. And it's a very cynical world that we live in, that the free movement of capital can function for corporations, but not for human beings, especially asylum seekers. Because think about it, if the only way a Starbucks or a Walmart that sets up shop in El Salvador or in Mexico can generate profit and revenue, that money has to leave the country and make its way back into the U.S. That's the only way they could make a profit. Those companies are not charities. But when working class migrants try to do the same under the same capitalist structure, it's not permitted. It's not allowed. It's being seen as criminal and otherwise, you know, all this other insane, stereotypical, xenophobic, racist nonsense. So I want to bring something up to you that I have noticed in all these viral videos, and that is of ICE raids that have a lot of these agents wearing masks to cover their identities. Even acting ICE director Todd Lyons, who we heard earlier, addressed the issue of wearing masks in the same press conference that we heard at the beginning of the show. So let's take a listen, and I want you to hear sort of the anger in his voice as he hastily and angrily returns to the podium. Let's take a listen.
I'm going to answer the mask question. So, No, not the mask, the mask. So a lot of agencies were invited to come out 2 weeks ago in Los Angeles where we ran an operation where ICE officers were doxxed. So let's just say that again. People are out there taking photos of the names, their faces, and posting them online with death threats to their family and themselves. So I'm sorry if people are offended by them wearing masks, but I'm not going to let my officers and agents go out there and put their lives on the line and their family on the line because people don't like what immigration enforcement is. They are wearing those masks because we ran an operation with the Secret Service where we arrested someone that was going online, taking their photos, posting their families, their kids' Instagram, their kids' Facebooks, and targeting them. So let me ask, is that the issue here, that we're just upset about the masks? Or is anyone upset with the fact that ICE officers' families were labeled terrorists?
It's about the identification, sir, because sometimes they just don't have labels.
So while Todd Lyons is presenting one narrative on this issue, both you and I have a different frame of reference on the meaning of state agents wearing masks. I mean, when I look at that, it looks like some of the military people that we've seen for generations in El Salvador wearing masks. Not just El Salvador, various other parts of Latin America as well. So based on that frame of reference, what do you make of the aesthetic of law enforcement suddenly looking like law enforcement in various parts of Latin America? I don't think it's by accident for me personally. I think there's a component of this that's by design because they're targeting people that look like you and me.
Yes, Oscar. So on the one hand, maybe he's right in the sense that these actions are unpopular and the immigrant communities and the citizen communities are pushing oppositions and are engaging in freedom of speech. They have the right to film these police operations in public spaces. And some of the times they even exercising civil disobedience, which is laudable. I didn't foresee it happening so fast, so quickly, all over the place. So in that sense, and yes, doxing people is not cool. And it has happened in a few incidents. But yes, more worrisome is the case that hiding your face, then you don't have the accountability that you do when you're a police officer representing the state. And then you have your name and your number identification so that if there's a violation of somebody's rights, you can file a complaint. That is in the Constitution. Grievance against a state for wrongdoing. If these people become anonymized, then it's harder to say who did what during one of those actions. Also, it means that you can have militia. So civilians that are very anti-immigrant that can mobilize themselves and pretend to be ICE agents or something, but they're just white nationalists or other things. We've seen that happen in the past. Mm. Also, as you were saying, in Latin America, we have dangerous precedents of what, for example, in Colombia, they called the paramilitaries.
Yes.
They were not members of the army. They were not police. They were hired by rich people to protect their lands, their interests, and all that. But they acted with violence, killed people with impunity, and it will be many years until some of them were paid collectively for their illegal, violent actions. So we're talking now in moving this into the area of political violence, where people is now unclear if they're actually members of the armed forces, which shouldn't be in the U.S. territory. That's illegal. If they are members of the police, which yeah, most local police are not doing this because of they haven't signed 287G agreements between local police and immigration forces. So this is ICE agents who more and more look militarized, right? They have these armored vehicles, they have these tanks, these have huge weapons that are completely necessary to arrest a woman, a worker, to go to a restaurant. They're acting like these are war zones. People are not buying it. They are saying, this is my neighborhood. You're not going to come and see and put fear on us like this. But then disguising themselves with these masks and all that gives them some anonymity that may allow them to behave in a way they wouldn't otherwise. So it's very dangerous that they do that. They don't want protesters on campus to put masks during protests. They want Harvard and Columbia to make that illegal, but they are doing the same. They don't like to be called terrorists, but they are calling Kilmer Garcia Arrigo a terrorist without any evidence in court. So these things are not going both ways. And this calls about the injustice of blaming or calling somebody an immigrant and not following the law and attacking civilians or attacking police officers conducting their job. But it's very, very blurry when you have, as we saw in New Jersey, a private detention center with some probably federal ICE agents protecting that detention center from a visit from local elected officials that were trying to get in and then trying to arrest the mayor of Newark and then charging a congresswoman from the area for trespassing or for touching violently an agent when they were pushing people around. So we're seeing here the physical confrontation of different parts of the federal government. And it's another example of the symbolic and sometimes pushing physical confrontation between the legislative Democrats, which are in the minority, and the federal agencies while the police are absent, maybe on purpose, and while the judiciary is very slow in saying what should happen.
Yeah, as you just said, that compared to a lot of the other things that we've mentioned during this discussion, it may seem like a minor detail, but much like the issue of remittances, this administration is playing with fire if they set this precedent of masked law enforcement or masked, who knows? Who knows exactly? We have about a few minutes left, so before we let you go, are there any other issues addressed in your book that you would like to point out, again, in the context of all these recent events that we've seen in the last week, week and a half alone, that people should be aware of? Because again, it's not just breaking down misperceptions, but also informing the public on a frame of reference that's missing in the narrative, this immigration narrative.
Yes, even though the book came before the elections, because he was trying to inform the public before they voted, it's still very relevant. And I really invite the public to read it. They will find it very accessible. A book written after a number of years to educate. And I think we do that. And those skills will make you a better citizen, a better analyst, a better journalist, a better policymaker. So not because I wrote it, Karin Nacional is my co-author, but we cite hundreds of colleagues that have been working on this issue for a long time, and we look at different case studies. So it is very relevant. And then I could come back to your previous question at the beginning of the interview, and it's something that we touch in the book. It's very dangerous when we see immigrants through the lens of crime or national security, because then we're going to have a military and national security response, which is going to overshoot, or we're going to frame them as terrorists, which has important legal, economic consequences nationally and internationally. But also then we're going to look for solutions that rather than solving the problem, they're going to make it worse. So something that was very dangerous from the visit of President Bukele to the White House was that it seemed that Trump was saying that he was going to emulate the Bukele model to bring criminality to zero magically from one day to another. But as you know, the context in El Salvador is very different. There was indeed an issue of areas controlled by organized crime and the gangs that is never been to that degree in the U.S. and probably will never will. So the solution, that it wasn't a solution, and we can talk a lot about that, but the situation in El Salvador and other places is so different that the U.S. has no business learning from that experience of human rights violations, apprehending people without the process, sending them far away, not letting them to talk to lawyers, not letting them see their families. That's what they were exporting the people there so that could happen. I mean, Kilmer Abreu Garcia has been there for months and may stay there forever. And even though we're not okay with it and we're following his case and that of Christian and others, there are over 100 people in that situation. They're in complete legal limbo. So that's something that has been used in other countries. Something that the U.S. tried to do in Guantanamo in the past didn't go very well. They were trying to do it with immigrants now. It didn't go really well. Bukele offered a solution. It became very polemic. So now they're trying to send people to Libya and all that. That is not the solution, as it is not to copy the saw from the president of Argentina, Milei, to try to slash public budgets to solve an economic crisis. That is only making things worse. So the U.S. has to find U.S. solutions, and they won't be able to solve the immigration challenges until they understand what the immigration reality is. And that's why scientific-based descriptions of the issue are crucial so we can find real solutions.
That's what's so important about your book, getting to the roots of the problem, because even if the Trump administration were to end tomorrow, even if this assault on immigrants and asylum seekers were to end tomorrow, there are still serious questions with regards to not only why people migrate in the first place, but the capitalist structures that lead people to migrate as well. And so with that said, we've been speaking with Ernesto Castaneda. He's the director of the Immigration Lab and the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at American University here in Washington. His latest book is entitled Immigration Realities, Challenging Common Misperceptions. Ernesto Castaneda, it's always been informative, insightful. Thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you so much, Oscar. A pleasure as always.
Absolutely. No problem. That said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios, nos vemos, ciao.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, January 6. Here are some headlines. Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced new sanctions yesterday on 4 judges of the International Criminal Court, 2 of whom voted to authorize an ICC investigation of U.S. military actions in Afghanistan, and 2 who authorized arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, the former Israeli defense minister. The sanctions, which freeze all U.S.-controlled property and assets of the 4, were imposed under an executive order issued in February by President Trump, which said the court, quote, has engaged in illegitimate and baseless actions targeting America and our close ally, Israel, close quote. In response, the ICC said the sanctions are, quote, a clear attempt to undermine the independence of an international judicial institution which operates under the mandate from 125 states' parties from all corners of the globe, close quote. In more news, at least 16 Palestinians were killed today by the Israeli military in Gaza, according to local health officials, while the Israeli army said 4 of its soldiers were killed and 5 were wounded by an explosion in a building in Khan Yunis to the south. This comes as Palestinians across the war-ravaged Gaza Strip mark the start of one of Islam's most important holidays, Eid al-Adha. With much of Gaza in rubble, men and children were forced to hold the traditional prayers outside destroyed mosques and homes, and with food supplies dwindling, families were having to make do with what they could scrap together for the 3-day feast. In other news, a federal judge has halted President Trump's latest attempt to prevent international students from attending Harvard University. Trump signed a proclamation on Wednesday to suspend international visas for new students at the school and directed the Secretary of State to consider revoking visas for current Harvard students who meet the proclamation's criteria. The temporary restraining order, issued late yesterday by U.S. District Judge Allison Burroughs, said that if she didn't intervene now, the school would, quote, sustain immediate and irreparable injury before there is an opportunity to hear from all parties. A hearing has been set for mid-June. And with more than 1,000 measles cases already reported in the U.S. this year, experts are urging vacationers to take extra precautions to avoid contracting the highly contagious virus. Dr. Scott Roberts, associate